This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Kirsten Holst.
Alison Malden.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Kirsten, you are a geriatrician.
That's right. I'm, as my late husband used to say, a doctor for old, which is the number plate he got me for my car.
Okay.
I think is a good descriptor. So, theoretically, most of my patients are over 65. I mean, it can be over 55 and of Maori and Pacifica origin, but most of the people that I deal with, in fact, are older than that. They're frail and older.
Okay. So is it an age ethnicity definition? You know, anyone over Pākehā over 65 is geriatric, yeah, or?
Well, they can certainly come into our service, but as I say, we tend to look after people who are frail, and frailty does increase with age, but certainly not all people who are in their 60s or 70s even are frail. They are not. Yeah. And I guess that it's just that we have limited resources.
Yes.
For okay. what we can do. I mean, everyone in New Zealand gets treated in the public health system, so but they come into hospital usually in an undifferentiated form.
Yeah, but there's special sort of requirements. Now, I did hear, as life expectancy increases, it doesn't mean that you have longer in your frail things. It's sort of the end of life period just shifts upwards. Would that be the case?
Yes, mostly everything moves through, so that we'd like to think that we're all going to live and be very healthy for as long as possible. But in fact, now that we have a lot of chronic conditions, people do approach older age with, I guess, a burden of health problems. And I guess that one of the things that a geriatrician really does is that rather than dealing with one system, like a cardiologist deals with hearts, respiratory physician deals with lungs, renal physician deals with kidneys, we try and deal with the whole person.
Yeah.
So that we might be dealing with people with heart problems and lung problems and kidney problems and neurological problems, so strokes and things like that. So if you ask me about what the bulk of my work is, it would be degenerative neurological conditions. So that includes dementia, particularly dementia, but it's things like Parkinson's disease and other less common problems. So I deal with people with motor neurone disease and a lot of people who have had strokes. We deal with people that have broken their hips because that's what is regarded as a fragility fracture. Is problematic. And we deal with people with chronic conditions that are now really limiting their life.
Yeah.
So people with, bad heart failure. Or people who have problems with COPD or asthma that are limited by breathlessness.
Yes.
And the sorts of problems that happen there. And I guess I work, I think sometimes I work as a detective trying to work out what the biggest problem that somebody has is, and then we do problem solving around that. And the thing that's quite nice about being a geriatrician is that actually being the doctor part of the team isn't necessarily terribly important. It might be going to be a physiotherapist or an occupational therapist or a social worker or the nurses that make the biggest difference to somebody's problem. So that, you know, like if you break your leg, getting up and around is an issue with mobility. Well, the same thing can be if you have heart failure. Getting around, you know, is a mobility issue because you're limited by breathlessness or chest pains or something like that. And, you know, so that looking at somebody's house, the access to their house, the layout, the access to their bathroom, particularly your toilet and your shower, those sorts of things. And obviously, you know, that they're not necessarily a medical problem to be able to fix that. I think that we, you know, we as a team in geriatrics, and we do work as a multidisciplinary team, it's about who can chip away at the corners of the problem. Rather than necessarily being in a situation where we're going to reverse the problem, where we're accepting that the problem is there, we're wanting to work out how you get bang for your bucks, how you get good life.
Yeah, I thought it was quite noticeable. You gave a presentation in a seminar series recently, and there was one graph where it showed your health sort of going down gradually. You might have a health event and it dips right down. You recover largely, but not quite as much, and then you carry on the downward trend, another dip and recovery. This is a sort of growing area, and there's growing knowledge with the aging population.
One of the things is I think I've chosen to work in a growth field, that's for sure, and that's a good thing. I think that people, as they age, things are more complex than they used to be, and so I hopefully see myself as being useful in a situation of complexity. And as I say, that's a bit why I see myself as a detective, working out what are going to be the things that I can make a difference with. Sometimes I make a really exciting diagnosis and I can do something miraculous with medicines and things like that. But, you know, in reality, most of the time, I'm not able to do a major miracle for somebody, but I might be able to actually get them back home and living as they want to live.
So really good. Now, as a sort of just an outside observer, I know it's like 50 years ago the big fear for older people was cancer. Is it now? Would it be dementia?
I think it's tricky. I think that a lot of people are worried about dementia, and I think that that's the thing that most people don't want to come to see me about. But it is a really actually quite a large part of my work, because memory problems feeds into the frailty syndrome, and your ability to respond within that is big. And I think that socially, we used to live in sort of extended family situations that you, as you grew older, it was likely that your children lived nearby. There might have been going to be a daughter that never moved out of home because her job was going to be to care for her parents and things like that. And now we tend to be, you know, much more dispersed, so that families are across the world. Really aware of that now in COVID times, I guess, how we would sort of always thought you could fly home if you come from the UK. You know, I work with a lot of people who thought that they could come to New Zealand and always would be able to fly home within 24 hours if something went wrong. And, you know, now we're in this awful situation where it's not like that. And I guess that, you know, a lot of people, you know, you make an assumption that, you know, you're going to work until you retire and then you're going to have an active retirement. And you don't necessarily plan for your children to be part of that. You might be, you know, you might have other good plans. you know, and as I say, and all of a sudden when you become more dependent on people, I think it's, you know, that's a tricky one.
But there's a lot being done to support independent living among young people.
Certainly. We know that if we tried to look after everyone in rest homes, we couldn't afford to do it as a country. You know, certainly the goal of caring for people is to keep them what we call aging in place, aging where they want to be living. And supporting them to be in that situation for as long as possible. And it's tricky, because one of the big things that people often say is, well, they don't want to, certainly they don't want to be a burden on anyone else, but they don't want to feel that they're dependent on anyone else either. And, you know, my view about it very much is that if somebody can help you do something boring, but gives you a little bit more energy for something that's exciting that you really want to do, go for it. I mean, I'm never going to be one that's wanting to clean the toilet. You know, if I've got a limited amount of energy to spend on something, it's not going to be cleaning the toilet, or possibly not cleaning very much of my house actually at all. I'm much happier to get somebody to come in and do something like that. So I have energy to do something that's fun.
Now, it's interesting you take that angle, because there were some of the studies looking at why in certain Japanese villages do people live to a great old age. And one possible explanation, they were saying, as they get old, they're still growing their own vegetables and things, but they have obligations to the people down the road. And so rather than say, I don't want to be a burden, they were each supporting each other, and they had that network.
I think that we've sold ourselves a bit short, I think, in New Zealand. I think that community living just isn't happening the way it should be. I mean, we used to say it takes a village to raise a child. Well, actually, it takes a village to grow old in as well, really. You do need to have interactions with other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, within Maori communities, they honour their older people, certainly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think as Pākehā we've necessarily taken all that on board the same way that we could have. You know, we need to take the good things out of a community situation. But, you know, that can be a very difficult thing, you know, in the Maori community as well, because family, again, are spread everywhere. It's not the way that it was. And it's, you know, even if you have a large family, it's not necessarily settling to move from one person for a period of time and then to the next family for a period of time. You know, we'd like to see it that the family were coming in.
Now, I know that angle from the sort of some older Asian people, they might have had even 10 or 12 children, so they can rotate around a month at each child through the year, which can work well. But also there is the issue, I think, and it might be as well, people moving into care. If they move away from their home environment with everything familiar around them, then that can actually have a very negative effect on their health.
Oh, certainly it can. I mean, and if you're mentally frail, so if you do have some memory problems, I mean, it is ideal to be in a familiar environment, because that makes things, dealing with routines and set things is a very helpful way of doing it. And you know, one of the things that if you have memory problems developing, getting into a system where you do have somebody coming in to help you, while you can adjust to that, is a really useful thing, rather than, you know, thinking that this is a strange new person coming in every day.
Yes.
I mean, if you can have met somebody and that they become your friend as well as your helper and carer, that makes a situation a lot better. Yeah.
So it's best to actually start early rather than put it off until the last minute.
Yeah. I think so. I think that that's, there's a bonus in doing that.
Yeah. So how long have you been working in this field?
It gets very worrying when you begin to talk about how long you've done your job these days. When I graduated, you then start working as a house surgeon. So you finish your six-year degree, and then you work as a trainee intern, and then you start as a house surgeon. And you work on three-month runs in different areas around the hospital. And I was one of those people that every time I started a new job, I thought, oh, this is going to be what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. This is just so fun.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what I'll do. And sometimes people can decide after they've done 2 years, so that's eight different specialty runs. Well, I wasn't there by that stage. I had another year. And then realised I did want to work in the hospital.
Why is that?
I like the community. I like community, and the hospital in Palmerston North is, I think that there's the city council, Massey University, and then the hospital as employers of groups of people, and size wise. And yeah, it's fun being part of a community.
So, okay, so the hospital community, you think, is strong and supportive, and they all pull together?
Yeah, or? I think that I certainly think that it it has been. I think that, you know, slightly less so maybe now because everyone's so busy and resources are so tight.
Yeah. Are there groups, or is there a hierarchy
of
doctors and nurses and specialists and administrators?
Well, I don't. Yeah, I think that there are. I mean, in the olden days, there was the medical superintendent, there was the chief nurse or matron, and then there was the accountant. And it's got more complicated than that.
Yeah,
but certainly. I think within the different areas within the hospital, and it gets chopped and diced up a little bit, all around. So that, I mean, geriatrics, healthy aging, and rehabilitation, we're a cluster, and we have a medical director, a nursing director, and a business director. So I guess
it is a little bit this old pattern,
but. There's more to it than that, and there's a whole lot of different governance groups. I mean, it's when I first started working at Palmerston North Hospital, which is over 30 years ago, we used to have a tea room, and at morning tea time, everyone used to stop their ward rounds, and the junior doctors, so the house surgeons and registrars, sat down one end of the tea room, and the consultants sat down the other end of the tea room. And a trolley was brought in, and it had a couple of urns of, you know, water or big teapots.
And chocolate biscuits for the consultants and plain.
Yes, it did.
There was a bit of it like that. And we all stopped, and we did a whole lot of things, you know, informally. So if you'd been on the ward round and you had somebody you didn't know quite what was going on, or you needed to ask a surgeon about something, or whatever, those things happened in an informal way. And, you know, it sounds really silly, but, you know, with the advent of an automatic hot water dispenser in the tea room so that you could come to morning tea at any time, we lost it. We lost it.
Is there a managerial layer that's come in and broken down some of the communication?
Doctors... doctors don't always want to deal with the money of these things.
Yes. Yeah.
And I've been through a number of restructures of the health system. So we were all in district health boards, and then we became CHEESE, Crown Health Organised Enterprises. And we've been with Wanganui for some of it, and then we go without Wanganui, and now we're back with Wanganui a bit for some of these things. And I don't know, I feel that I'm somewhat jaded in a little bit about it, because I've tried to restructure so many times that my preparedness to engage, I sometimes just think, well, actually, I could just see patients, because that's much more fun. Yeah.
I saw the same at university. You get a new staff member saying, oh, we've got this other structure now, we should be doing this. And you think, well, you wait another couple of years, there'll be another structure.
I don't know. Sometimes I think my energy is less, so that my ability to... I cleaning the toilet, I guess I've energy.
Why do it? Yeah.
I prefer to spend it in my garden with my animals, those sorts of things now, rather than living at the hospital, which is what you do when you're a junior doctor. And you are very close to people if you're working 16-hour days, which we still work a long shift to cover, you know, the daytime shift, and then we'll have a night shift. You get close to people in the situation when there aren't very many of you around, and when you're supporting each other in emotionally difficult times, because in fact health is quite emotionally difficult quite often.
Yeah. Now that is an interesting aspect, because they have said with someone going to become a doctor, and the sort of hours that they're expected to do as part of the training, which in most other occupations they simply wouldn't put those demands on people. Does it make sense? Can you see the rationale?
It's really tricky. I mean, I think it's difficult, because I think that, you know, we can still do a lot of medicine Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, for things like clinics and, you know, potentially organised operating lists and things like that. You know, that they can easily happen that way. But in fact, you know, running a hospital, you need to have people there 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
But because things aren't necessarily as busy in the middle of the night, we hope that they're not going to be too many disasters that happen in the middle of the night. You don't need to have so many people on. So it gets difficult because, you know, we know to do things most effectively, you have experienced people at the front door helping triage things. But in fact, when you're old like me, you don't actually want to be there at 3 o'clock in the morning as much as you might have been. So when I started working in Palmerston, I used to do acute medicine as well as geriatrics when I started as a consultant. So that left me on call for a 24-hour period, you know, once a week. And it meant that I would go home, but in the evening I was available if there were problems or if somebody needed my opinion about something, and I would have to go into the hospital. And that's fine, but I think it does get harder as you get older to be as sharp at 3 o'clock in the morning as I might be during the day. And we haven't quite got into a system where we could say, okay, when you've been on call, you don't have to think so much the next day. because, you know, what's good for the patient care is for me then to be looking after the patients that I've heard about that day before. You want to have continuity, and it gets very difficult to get that balance right. I mean, I think that, you know, what everyone really wants when they have like your family doctor, your GP, you'd actually like to get to know them. You'd like to know that you're going to see some person, you're not going to see somebody that you have to tell a new story to every time. So having some continuity is a nice thing.
So that's important just for a holistic approach to health.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so. And
so are we moving away from that now?
I think that we're moving into a much more episodic.
Yeah, because when they talk about more flexible hours and shift work, part-time work and job sharing and so on.
Those things, it does mean that you have to be, people have to be flexible and...
have you seen a big change in that? I mean, at one time there was the idea you dedicated health worker is putting in a lot of time, but maybe get support in the home, and now we've got a different structure with
I think that I certainly think that, you know, it's changed in a general practice situation that you no longer expect out of hours if you'd be able to ring your own doctor. You know that
You book an appointment 3 weeks ahead, unless you've overcome the problem before you see the doctor.
There's a bit about that, and I have to say, you know, very interestingly, that is a problem in our area, particularly in Auckland and in maybe the Hawke's Bay, and in Christchurch and Dunedin, where they have a lot more GPs per capita. Where, you know, we've somehow got into a situation that's quite difficult in our area.
I looked up the other day, something like one GP for every 1,400 people, would that be about right?
That's a sort of a pretty ideal situation.
Really?
Yeah, we sometimes sort of have double that number of people per GP in relation to where people are in Auckland.
So when my friend says she goes to the GP and she's got this special problem and she looked it up on the internet and the GP didn't know and he's not looking into it, there's a very good reason why he's not got the time. Yeah.
It can be tricky,
Do you find that the internet, you know, you've got either these old people or their families looking stuff up and coming in? Is it an advantage that they're more informed or a disadvantage that they've got wacky stuff?
I have to say, I think it's an advantage to be, to have a degree of health literacy. I certainly think that there's an advantage. I think that one of the things, and I think about this from a junior doctor perspective as well, you know, when you don't know all the answers as a junior doctor, not that you know all the answers when you're a senior doctor most of the time, but, you know, you develop expertise in knowing what you're likely to see.
Yes.
And things like that. And you, I don't know that there was always a thing that, you know, if you hear hoofbeats going past your window, as you get more senior, you'll think that that's a horse going past in, mm-hmm. in New Zealand, likely to be, whereas you don't think it's a zebra.
Yeah.
Or you don't, I don't know, it's not an okapi or a bison or something like that. You know, we know
you've got what's, a clear idea
what's coming.
Be,
and I think that, you know, one of the problems from a junior doctor point of view is that there's so much information out there. If you, you know, you look something up on Dr. Google, there's just so much information. You can't tell whether this is a zebra's hoofbeats or a horse's hoofbeats that you're hearing.
But that will have to be a big problem for a GP, won't it? Because sometimes you've got certain things that the symptoms could just be a basic cold, or it could be something far more. And they're, well, I see so many of these and it's just a cold. Yeah. So you're likely to dismiss something?
I think that, and that's where I think that continuity, you know, is more important. So that if somebody... if you have a relationship with somebody and you say, well, I think this is a cold, these are the things to look out for, and you know, that these would be what we call red flags, you know, something that's suggesting it's more of a problem. Then they might be able to come back to you, and it's lovely if you can then work it up for the next step along the way.
Yeah, if you follow them through, and if it keeps repeating or
you actually think, oh shit, I have to think of something else here. You know, this pattern isn't this isn't the pattern I was expecting.
Yeah. Now we've got more of the computerized records you can log into. Is that a help?
I think it is a help. I think, as I say, I think that people having understanding of their health problems is a really important thing. It's, you know, we expect to be told, you know, even a bad diagnosis now, whereas, you know, we can still think of times where people, you know, told the family that somebody had cancer and not the patient themselves.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.